Hi, I'm Katie.
And I'm Chris, and this is the EdShift Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the EdShift Podcast. Really excited to be joined today by someone who I crossed paths with when Chris and I were at South by Southwest last year, and who, you know, I was sort of immediately intrigued in, you know, the concept. And I think also your branding for me and Dana. You had a canoe, I think, on your business card, and I was like, I like this woman. Dana Gasping-French has over two decades of experience in education. She served as an ESL and bilingual teacher, an instructional coach, a school and district level administrator as well. During all seasons of her career, her one constant has been engagement around the design and facilitation of engaging, meaningful professional learning experiences that focus around inclusive systems and practices for multilingual learners. Super, super important work. Her asset-based approaches to different language, socioeconomics, culture, and language are all at the heart of her work. She's co-authored the text Teaching English Language Learners, Content and Language in Secondary Classrooms. She is currently the CEO and lead consultant for Upriver Education, where she partners with school communities around this idea of thinking upriver and redesigning systems that advocate for all members. She lives with her husband, her three children, two pups, and a tortoise. We need to talk about that a little bit more. but first, let's dive in and talk a little bit about Upriver Education, Dana. There's this quote on the website for your work that's, there comes a point where we need to just stop pulling people out of the river, and we need to go upstream and find out why they're falling in. And I love that. And I think, gosh, that's so applicable to so much in education right now. Mm-hmm. But let's start there. Tell me more about the thought process and the thought process behind Upriver Education generally.
So, you know, I came across that quote by the late Desmond Tutu reading another book on a different topic entirely one day, and it just worked on me. It was something that, you know, started to spin in the background in my head, and I recognize, kind of like you say, Katie, the applicability of that to so many scenarios. And at the time, I was working as a director for a multilingual learner department in a mid-sized urban district. And I started thinking, okay, well, what does that really mean if we think upriver? You know, what are the rapids? What does that all look like? And I started to then question whether or not I was actually complicit in a system that I was expecting students to fail. You know, was intervention an inevitability, essentially, for multilingual students? Were we really interrogating our core belief in the capacity of our students to achieve the first time within these systems? Or were we essentially accepting that these were systems that were marginalizing these students in particular? And, you know, I see a lot of programs that are set up essentially as interventions, and it still lands as a little bit, maybe pushy or kind of out there to say ESL is not an intervention. People are still surprised to hear that. And so I recognized while working in the system that there were so many pieces that I could advocate for that weren't moving because we were part of this larger process that was actually not expecting students to succeed the first time. And we weren't training and supporting our educators to make that happen. And so not only did we lack confidence in the students, we lacked confidence in ourselves as educators to actually complete that task and do that job. So moving, thinking, planning upriver essentially is saying, you know, we are systems. I don't come into schools with a list of 10 strategies. Everyone loves a good list of strategies, but we go to bed at night and we go back to factory settings, and we don't actually ever move the needle here, right? So a lot of the work I do starts with the messaging that's coming out of systems. I like to say that I'm trying to reduce these individual educators being the sole advocate for multilingual students, which is really common, and creating systems that are the advocate for kids.
I think that's amazing and so important. Like, so it's been 20 years. I'm going to really age myself right now since I was in the ESL classroom, but like every problem you just highlighted, like those were the challenges that were facing my kids. Like I was 100% their advocate, but the system wasn't set up for them. And there wasn't, I'm going to say something that I don't really want to say out loud, but it wasn't the presumption that they would succeed. And they were a bit of a burden in some of the other places that they were because our teachers weren't empowered to help them. We had kind of this like, okay, well, we're going to do ESL and it's going to be in this classroom, but we have to put these kids in these other places and we'll see what happens when we're there, but we haven't given the teachers the tools that they need. And so, things don't work. And it's really frustrating for the kids, right? I mean, the number of times I'd go and retrieve my kids from in-school suspension because they hadn't done their homework. I'm like, did we think that through at all before we made those decisions? But, you know, like it's a struggle because if we make an expectation for other students and there's a consequence for them, and then we want these students to also meet that, but they're not ready, right? They don't have the language to deliver. Mm-hmm. And we haven't started to look at what are other ways of representation? What are other things they can do? How do we ask one question, right? And the question is, what do you understand about this content and how can you communicate it to me in a way that makes sense for you and for me? But instead we're asking them to show they understand the content and show that they've mastered language all at the same time. And so I'm really interested to understand, like, as you go in and you see these systems, like, how do we move the needle? Like, what are things, and even like listeners who are joining the podcast today and may not be ESL teachers, but are teaching in, you know, content area classrooms, like what helps, what can they do? What are just like ways to reframe our thinking, like small pieces like that to help these students be successful? Because by and large, my experience was a bunch of brilliant kids had a lot to share and show with us, and we needed to build the systems to let them do it.
That's right. Yeah, that's a terrific question. And one of the things you bring up, I hear over and over again, is that, you know, a lot of ESL teachers feel the same. Right. So I happen to do, I have an ESL teacher online course and cohorts that we go through. And during that time, we are able to bring ESL teachers together from all these districts in different corners of the country and actually overseas as well. And they're facing the same pieces. So, and it's today, not 20 years ago. So we need to do something, right? We need to start saying, okay, what is going to actually impact this and make that change to your question? To me, what I keep coming back to, and I often start with, is role definition. So the first module of our course always talks about clarity and really understanding our roles as educators. And what I love to do is throw up a slide that shows a bunch of preschoolers playing soccer. Because if you have children or if you've ever watched a game of preschoolers playing soccer, what do? They swarm, right? They all are doing the same thing. They have a very simplified concept of the goal, right? Or the end goal, which is to like put ball in net, right? And either net, right? It doesn't matter. yet they're so fixated on that they don't, and perhaps developmentally, of course, this is a different question, but they're not part of a system here, right? They just understand that the most important piece is being in control of that ball. And so they all try to do that. And then I'll put up a slide that shows, you know, a more professional team of footballers, as it were. And there's such orchestration happening. And there's a real respect for difference in roles and a respect for understanding the roles that all do work towards that same end goal, but we're not all directly working on that goal at the same time. So what I often see is that ESL teachers are misunderstood. People don't know what they do. The most common question they receive is, so what do you do anyway? And I like to tell the story of the first building. I was an ESL teacher and it was a K-8 building, so 9 grade levels. I had 13 plannings because I had newcomers as well as more established multilingual students. And sometimes I had small groups of 2 or 3. And I would say probably once a week, a teacher would walk by and see my small group and say, you can probably guess, must be nice. And that really like hit hard because while it was nice and in the relationships I built, they were wonderful. And I loved the students and I love that piece about my role. It didn't mean it was simple. And so often these, you know, young people are coming into these roles and they're trying to fit into a school community with other colleagues because we're humans as well. And they want to legitimize what they're doing. And the best way they know how to do that is by playing soccer like a preschooler. They start to try to legitimize their role by replicating what their colleagues are doing. And so they become content support, right? They become the fixer, the keeper, right, of students. And they put out the immediate fires because at the end of the day, they can say they did something, right? And they moved the needle forward in terms of helping a child. Yet if we stop and we really like, ask the system, ask guidance to find the backpacks for the kids who need backpacks, right? Ask the lunch office to send home the forms in the native language that's requested the first time. We free up the ESL teacher to actually do the job that she has been asked to do, which is to equip students with the language that's going to give them access to the language of instruction, right? Or the vehicle for instruction. Because you brought up a really great point, Chris, about like this double cognitive load that happens, right? When students are learning a new content in a new language, that's quite a challenge and it's exhausting. And when we try to legitimize what we're doing by replicating content and putting all this heavy content into ESL classrooms without controlling for that, then essentially we're just doubling down the cognitive load and we're not giving them opportunity to grow linguistically. So all that being said, I think the difference in roles and expecting difference, having parity among educators and shared ownership is really a beautiful and wonderful place to start because then those professional relationships can grow and then collaboration actually starts to make more sense, right? Because collaboration is sort of this gold standard and no one ever defines what that can look like. But if you don't understand your roles, you don't see where they dovetail.
Oof, that was good.
I thought about it for like a minute. So
when I want to kind of dive into this collaboration piece because I think that's really key. And when I think about the things I'm passionate about, right? It's like, mm-hmm. How do we give kids a voice? And for me, part of that role of the ESL teacher in that collaborative space is helping possibly, and I'm going to really look to you to kind of tell us more here, but like, how do they help build opportunities for students in those content classes by helping the content teachers understand what expression could look like, and that it doesn't have to look like all the things that they maybe have been historically doing. Like, is that something you talk about and what are some things you share there to really empower that collaboration between the ESL teacher and the content area teacher to go deeper. So it is not just putting out those fires, which is so true. I've put out so many fires as an ESL teacher.
Yeah. So when ESL teachers wear all these other hats, what they essentially do is they stop focusing on the job at hand, which is the English language development. And I want to pause and say, this doesn't mean that English is any more important. I do like to decenter English in my work because I think sometimes we believe that it's like this, you know, kind of language that has some sort of higher level of respect or should, you know, incur a higher level of respect. Really, the goal is access for students. The goal is not English.
Yes.
And multilingualism, right? And really upholding that native language or languages, because some of these students come, you know, already multilingual. So anyway, like, you know, in terms of collaboration, once the ESL teacher and the system can start to support students in a deeper way, the ESL teacher then, sometimes it's scary, has to say, oh, well, now I can do English language development. Now I can actually spend my time doing that. The struggle here is there's often very little guidance around that, and there's often very little understanding on the part of those administering these programs, especially if they don't have enough students to have a director who grew out of the field itself, right? So there's sometimes the lack of confidence around what effective English language development looks like. And gaining clarity around what that looks like is actually what starts to inform that collaboration. So once teachers know exactly where they're focused, where they want their students to go, we start to come into that sort of that, you know, instructional assessment cycle that you know, we're all that pedagogical cycle we're taught when we learn how to teach. But right now, we don't know how to assess students for their English level. We don't know how to assign them let's say you're a WIDA state, which many of us are, a WIDA level when it's not access testing season, right? So once we have an awareness of sort of the trajectory of English language development, then on these two train tracks, this is the switch points, right? These are the points at which we can bring awareness to our content colleagues around what is, like Jeff Spears likes to say, water, trying to explain water to a fish, right? When you try to explain academic language to a content expert, they just live and breathe it. They use it so naturally that they don't necessarily, they know how to call out what we refer to as like the tier three language, the, you know, the words that are bold in their textbook, the photosynthesis, right? What they may not realize are all of, like you're saying, are all the other hidden requirements we have of students. So when I love to work with functional language in the many of the standards and in the WIDA standards for sure, there's a real focus on functional language. And it's the language that actually helps us communicate content, but it's agnostic of content. It means, you know, it's the language of cause and effect. What's beautiful, and this is what we've developed here at Upriver in terms of curriculum guidance, is that the language of cause and effect can be applied anywhere. So we can utilize the language of cause and effect to talk about what happens when, you know, I walk inside with muddy shoes. Like how do my parents react to that, right? You know, well, if this, then this. We can then take that same structure and that same language and apply it to a chemical reaction, right? We can apply that to a character choice in a novel. And so often when we try to do that quickening and that legitimizing of content and that kind of preschool swarming where we just go straight to the end goal, we feel so much urgency around the content that we do what you suggested, Chris. We double down on the language and the content at the same time instead of scaling up. So my recommendation really is, let's find those crossbars. That's the academic language. Allow the ESL teacher during ELD to really introduce that in a way that's engaging, that allows the students to imprint on their learning experience. I recommend what I call the ESL language experience approach, where we take a familiar experience, we take something that the students can have choice in and give them power, and then we apply the academic language to that experience. And what that does is it creates engagement and buy-in, and then it also creates sort of the relics of that direct instruction become this indirect supports in the mainstream classroom area. So that's your collaboration. That's where you say to the teacher, we just finished cause and effect. These are the sentence frames we used that they already know. This is the anchor chart that we co-created. Can we put this up in your classroom? And you know, nowadays that used to be really hard when I was teaching, right? We had to literally like redrawing posters. But nowadays with like all, you know, everything being digitized, it's like, it's a click
so easy.
Button. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a lot in your question, and I hope I kind of addressed all those pieces, but you know, ultimately that student voice piece too is a big direction that I'm going, because I do think students feel like they're, you know, they're not just like visiting a new school and trying to become, and sometimes for them it's not new, but often the language doesn't feel like a language that they're using to imprint on the world, right? They're borrowing it to get a job done. So how do we create learning experiences where they actually have a little power?
And I think that's such an important point, that if you haven't experienced it, you don't always immediately recognize. But having grown up moving between languages and having to do to work both professionally and to, you know, as a student to work in a different language, like students don't always feel like they're the same person. Like your identity is tied to your language. And if we think about like our speech patterns and the things that we say. And like, you know, immediately like, oh yeah, so-and-so always says that. Like, so that's so much of your identity and so much of your personality mm-hmm. and so much of who you are. And when you're now being asked to do a task in a different language that you're not as familiar with, like you don't have that connection to it and you don't necessarily feel like the same person. And so anytime we ask a student then to do something like get up and talk or write something or express themselves in this language, like it's hard. Like there's a barrier there that you may not recognize for our students. And it's, you know, I think that that's an important piece to call out
mm-hmm.
because at the same time, a lot of these kids are figuring out who they are. And so it's a tough time, you know, both in how their brain is developing, how their personality is developing. And now we've layered these other pieces onto it. And there's a lot of space to make for that, just to help these kids feel successful. And then I think sometimes just depending on how, why, when their trajectory on getting there, like there could also be a lot of stress and trauma that we need to be aware of as well. And so I think it's so multifaceted how we like really help these students come into their own and be successful.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. And I think you said something like making space. There's a lot of newcomers coming in right now to a lot of school systems that have either never received newcomers or perhaps haven't seen them at this clip. And I get a lot of calls around this and it's always a panic. Right. It's always this feeling of what do we do? And I often look at ESL message boards and even ESL professionals are saying, oh, my goodness, I have a newcomer tomorrow. What do I do? And, you know, you mentioned making space. We have to kind of take ourselves out of like the sort of the navel of that. Right. And put this right, right there. Because this is a huge experience for this child. And what we do is a lot simpler, right? We don't hold them to a benchmark that wasn't designed for them. You know, what we do is we make them comfortable and we give them exposure and experience and let them know that they belong and ask questions about themselves, right? Instead of just trying to shoehorn them into a certain way. I had an ESL teacher who participated in one of our cohorts share this story that has always sat with me. She said, I had this girl as a newcomer years ago who would just get up in the middle of the class and started doing like back walkovers, right? She would do a back bend and then do a walk. And I'd always say, you know, you have to sit down at class. You have to sit down. I'd redirect her. And she, sure enough, she'd do it again. You have to sit down. And she said years later, she came back to visit and she was now proficient in English as well. And she said, you know, Miss, do you know why I used to do all those silly gymnastics? And she said, no, I don't want, no, why? You tell me, I remember that. She said, because I wanted you to know I was good at something. I come back to that story mentally, like in privately all the time when we think about newcomers. They're humans having a really intense human experience. Some
experience.
A level at which we, some of us may never understand.
And if they identify as, you know, smart or well-spoken or intelligent, like that story just resonates with me because it is so hard to sometimes show that if you haven't mastered the language, like you couldn't. But these kids want connection. And it actually makes me think of a student that I had. She was the one I retrieved more than once from in-school suspension. She was just a lovely, lovely girl. And so outgoing and just wanted connection and just didn't have the language, but she would draw things or make things. Like she was so creative and she was always like bringing things and she brought food all the time. And it was like, it's that need like to show the people who are now with you most of the time during the day, who are now significant in your world, that you are so much more than what the 10 words of English that they can communicate with you in are telling you. And same student, 3 years later, she was working in a restaurant, just delightful, had mastered English and it was really successful. But yeah, like it, I will never forget her because she just wanted that connection and she wanted to be a part of things, much like, you know, the student who's doing backbends, like they want to show us what they're great at and they don't have access to the same language that we do. And so how do we allow for that in the things that we're doing with them?
Yeah, I think ultimately all kids are just asking, you know, is school for me? Is this a place for me? And they have this inner wisdom, you know, at all levels. And I think when we see students acting out, when we see students in school suspension or disengaging, I think their inner kind of compass is saying, this isn't for me, right? So I have to figure out another kind of way of being, or I'm going to disengage, or I'm going to do what I can do to kind of save myself from this situation. And so if we can send that message that this is for you, come as you are, then down the line, the learning and the academics will come. We have to trust that they have the capacity for that. You know, we have to trust that we can get them there and that they're intelligent enough to come along when their time is there.
One of the things I often talk about, Katie can confirm, is that, you know, kids have to come to school and see the pathway that connects it to the future that they think is theirs. And when they don't, then you get the disengagement. And so it really is about helping them find their place there.
Yeah.
Dana, you mentioned a little bit about some of the, like the volume of newcomers and schools and districts that haven't necessarily, you know, had those individuals in their communities before. You know, that's something that feels new and consistently evolving. What are some of the other sort of maybe not new, but increasing or emerging challenges right now? Because there's a lot going on out there in the world. What are some of the other challenges that are facing today's multilingual learners, and how can we turn them into opportunities where possible?
Oh, yeah, I love that. Like, you know, how can we make them opportunities? I think at its core, you know, a society is always a shifting thing, right? And the challenge, I think, when communities shift is that we don't necessarily always embrace that right away. And so there's a lot of great work happening in a lot of districts around, you know, those other pieces aside from just the language learning, in terms of like being culturally aware and culturally humble and culturally responsive in the eventual, right? I think I was talking to to Ken Shelton the other day, who does a lot of DEI work, and he was saying, we were both presenting at an opening day conference in a district, and you know, he was saying, how can you be culturally responsive to a culture you don't know about, right? So I think that burgeoning awareness that we need to learn, we need to, like as he says, be in proximity to different cultures. That one of the biggest themes I'm seeing is, what is the difference between like tolerance and real true and radical welcoming, right? And inclusion. And communities are now starting to see, I think this is a big theme, that it's not just about saying like, oh, we'll create a classroom for you and we'll teach you how we do it. But if a community is being imprinted by all of its members, and we are truly responding to be culturally responsive, means we start to see that we are the community, right? So what does that mean for our lunch menus, right? What does that mean for the signage in our buildings? Yes, English is the language of instruction, but what message are we sending when we don't even like label bathrooms in the languages of, you know, our newcomers? I was working with a district partner administrator of mine who's right now outside of Boston. They're receiving like hotels full of Haitian Creole immigrants who have been placed into a hotel in their town. And, you know, they have, I'm not sure, maybe 60 newcomers coming in. And the first thing we're thinking about is signage, you know, because now these are not visitors to this community, and whether or not they're transient is moot because they are here and this is their reality today. And so I think one of the biggest pieces is that, what is community? That age-old townieism, or, you know, I used to work in a district that was very proud to say they bled blue, which meant they were like born and raised there, and so were their parents, and so were their parents. But I think that realization that actually isolates folks that are now trying to incorporate into a community. We have to be flexible around that. So that's a really big piece. in the field itself, we're seeing that reflected in some of the recommendations of practice. When I started to teach, you know, we talked a lot about code switching, right? Where we would work in English here, and then perhaps they could have some discrete time in their native tongue here. Now, in the research and it's reflected in our standards documents in many places, is this concept of translanguaging, where we code mesh, right? Where we go back and forth. We cognitively benefit from each language, right? We can kind of scale up and add on, and our brain is not going to be confused by that. In fact, and then recommending to families that don't recommend that they speak English at home, recommend that they speak the language that they're most comfortable in. They're going to bond better. They're going to have more cognitively complex conversations in their primary language. You know, they're going to have deeper connection as a result and deeper cognitive development too. But allowing that to happen in school too is one of the pieces that's coming into the field really, really deeply right now. And that's exciting.
I love that. I think about, you know, I try to put myself in the shoes of someone having that experience of having to, you know, leave my home and living in a hotel and everyone around me speaks a language that I don't speak. That seems terrifying. Like, I think that, you know, at any age, that seems like a remarkably challenging experience. And I think just acknowledging that as a starting point, right? Like, yeah. And that gives a foundation to move from when we acknowledge the challenge, we acknowledge the difficulty, and being able to move forward from there and doing it in a really thoughtful way, as you're saying, and looking at what are we learning is true and how can we do better.
And you know, I always like to say, you know, like any kind of process, any procedure, any system we have set up should be serving us, right? And it was set up to serve. And often we become allegiant to this, to a system or a process because it's the way we do it. But the way we do it was set up as a reflection of the community it was serving, or the system or the school or whatever it was serving. And so if that essential group that it's being served is shifting, then the process needs to shift as a result, right? So are we looking at, like, there's a lot of focus right now on trauma-informed classrooms. I think that's a beautiful thing. Are we training our mental health professionals in trauma that's specific to the populations that we're seeing, and you know, or are we othering, right? Are we really only looking at one kind of trauma, and that's often, you know, a trauma around, you know, that's not necessarily specific to, you know, displaced people or refugee experiences. And that's not to say every multilingual learner falls in one of those groups, but there are many students coming in that, you know, are in schools that have trauma-informed classrooms and training, but not this trauma, right? And are we specifying, you know, our training to really meet, you know, who's the we that we're serving?
That's so important. So important. Dana, thank you so much. Thank you for being here. I think we could talk forever. Dana, one final question that we like to ask on the EdShift podcast. Hopefully it's not too skill testing, but we'd love to know what the best part of your day has been today.
The best part of my day today, aside from talking to the two of you.
Yes. Yes.
So the best part of my day is that my daughter has a callback for her. A musical. And Ooh. Yeah. And so she came home from her third day of middle school. And the fact that I can be there now because of this role that I have to receive her, to give her a big hug, to wish her, you know, well, not luck, to tell her to break a leg, was and continues to be the most meaningful thing to me, because, you know, I spent a lot of years commuting a great distance and, you know, being gone from the house between 6 and 5. And so that will never be lost on me, just having that kind of stolen time with my kiddos.
Before we go, would love for you to share, you know, we've touched on some of the bits and pieces about what Upriver Education does. Would love for you to share a little bit more about your offerings and where people can find you and learn more.
Absolutely. So, you know, our website is uprivereducation.com. Also primarily on Instagram at @upriver_education, or you can just find me directly on LinkedIn by name. But essentially, we work with districts. I work with state agencies as well in terms of really soup to nuts looking at district program reviews. Many districts are seeing a growth in their population and they're not actually sure how to set up for success. What can we actually do to ensure that we have a framework, that we have protocols in place? So we do a lot of that work. We also do direct teacher training for content classroom teachers, for administrators, as well as direct ESL educators. And then we also have a curriculum guide that allows teachers that ESL planning approach, ESL experience planning approach that we talked about. So it's essentially these guardrails for like a linguistic expectation. A lot of ESL teachers are really struggling between this bind of either do I buy or advocate to buy this really expensive scripted curriculum that doesn't quite meet the diversity of students I have in front of me, or do I just make it up and, you know, teacher pay teacher my way through each lesson? So this provides a third way that I've had a lot of great feedback with. And so I am now quite busy with that work. And then, of course, I'm always available for speaking in keynotes, and I love talking about these larger concepts with districts and educators.
We will put all of Dana's information, where you can find her, where you can find Upriver Education, in our show notes. And Dana, thank you so, so much for being here with us today. Like I said, you know, could certainly keep rolling for plenty of time on this conversation, but I think some really good takeaways and some really important ways of thinking about our systems and our multilingual learners and our ESL teachers as humans and as all of the things that we can do in this space to support everyone, to support everyone that needs it. And so thank you, listeners. We appreciate you tuning into this episode of the EdShift podcast, and we hope that you have a great day.